And hello again, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today my guests are T. Jefferson Parker and Mark Bittner. First up is T. Jefferson Parker. He's the author of 12 previous novels, including the Edgar Award-winning Silent Joe and California Girl. His new book is The Fallen, published by William Morrow. Here he is. Hi, Jeff.
Well, hi, Barbara. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good.
Well, you know, how do you do it time after time? Another wonderful book. How is this?
I'm so glad to hear that. I'm glad that you liked it. You're a tough audience because you read a lot, so that means a lot to me to hear that.
Well, you know, I always look forward to your work, your new work, and I just put off reading it until closer to the show, and it was difficult putting it off. But when I finally started, I couldn't put it down, of course, and all sorts of questions went through my mind. I love that your main character has synesthesia, and I wonder if you would talk about that and how that idea came to you and really the overall idea for the book.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. You did a good job of pronouncing it. I found 95% of the population can't pronounce the word synesthesia, and I'm usually among them. So you did a good job. You know, I didn't know the first thing in the world about synesthesia until a couple of years ago. I was doing a signing for a book called Black Water that I'd written, and in that book, one of the main characters is shot in the head in the opening scene, and he lives through the shooting, but he incurs some very interesting brain damage because of that bullet in there. And after the signing, a woman came up to me and said, "Well, you're interested in the human brain, aren't you?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm very curious about the human brain. I've seen them injured, and I've seen them challenged by disease, and I've seen them bounce back and reconfigure and rewire themselves, if you will, and in almost miraculous ways. So, yes, I'm a big respecter of the human brain." She says, "Well, have you heard of synesthesia? Do you know what synesthesia is?" I said, "No, I don't, but I'll look it up." And I looked it up, and lo and behold, it's a fascinating thing. Syn, meaning mixing, aesthesia, the Greek, meaning sensation. It's mixed sensations, literally, or a mixing of the senses, and that is people who see music, quote-unquote, people who hear numbers, quote-unquote, people who experience sensual things in two different ways, in mixed ways, is what a synesthete is. It's associated with autism, and it's associated with hallucinogenic drug use, synesthesia. Very interesting stuff, so I decided to give a healthy case of it to my main character.
Well, I just love that idea. I think somewhere in the book you mentioned it as possibly being a gift, and I've looked at it that way, actually.
Are you synesthetic?
No, I'm not.
You're not?
but I have, you know, what I have known about the disease, I've thought, wouldn't it be wonderful to, you know, see music as color or color as music, or to have other, you know, sort of a couple of things going on at once?
Yeah. It sounds interesting to me, too. I'm not synesthetic, and I'm not close with anyone synesthetic, although I've talked to some synesthetes. And, you know, one of the interesting things, Barbara, is none of the synesthetes that I talk to and none that I've read their writings about synesthesia have considered it anything other than a gift.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they never refer to it as an affliction or as a hazard or as a handicap. They're all glad to have it. In fact, there were a couple of famous French poets, and I'll mispronounce their names or get them wrong, so I won't even attempt it. But two French poets back in the 1900s, one of whom was renowned for his poetry and his synesthesia, and the other one was renowned for his poetry, and he didn't have synesthesia, and he was just extremely jealous that he couldn't contact a case of it for himself, so his poems would be better. He wanted it in the worst way. Yeah.
I understand. If you just tune in, I'm talking with T. Jefferson Parker, author of The Fallen, published by William Morrow. So then what came first, the idea that your main character, Robbie Brownlaw, would have synesthesia or the synesthesia and wanting to just use it somehow?
Well, you know, kind of the latter, you know. After I talked to that woman at the signing and did a little bit of research about synesthesia, I knew that I wanted to try to build my main character around that somehow in the book, or have him have that. And but then separately, I kind of hatched the idea of a young, affable San Diego City policeman, which is what Robbie is when the book opens. And then I decided to try to find a way to give him synesthesia. You know, scientifically, most synesthetes are born that way, I think. Mm-hmm. And most of them do not come to it by head injury, as does Robbie. Although I did talk to a woman at signing the other night who was in a car accident and was heavily synesthetic for 3 or 4 months after that accident until the swelling in her brain went down and it slowly went away. So I think that I would venture to say that you can get synesthesia from a head injury like Robbie does in the second page of The Fallen.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, I want to talk a little bit about the voice of the book as well, because you always seem to do a slightly different thing with voice. And the voice of this narrator is sort of innocent. He has an innocent voice. There's something going on. Were you trying for that, or how did the voice of Robbie Brownlaw come to you?
You're perceptive to notice that. You're the first one who said that. And yeah, exactly. I wanted Robbie tells the story, with the exception of the very first chapter, kind of a prologue. Robbie tells the entire story, and it's in his voice, of course. And I wanted to write in a voice that was that belonged to an affable, I think you'd call him optimistic. Maybe at times you would call him slightly naive. I think you might call him innocent and kind of expecting the best in people in a way that you don't find a lot of people in uniform believing anymore, you know. So yeah, Robbie is all those things, and I wanted to write a story about a man who is so fantastically in love with his wife, for one example, that he cannot really genuinely see the truth of her until she has told him that truth over and over and over again. So Robbie's a bit stubborn too.
Hmm. Yeah, he's such a sympathetic character. I don't know that you care about something like that, but I just, you know, was captured by his voice immediately.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Will you read to us?
Sure. What do you want to hear?
Why don't you start at the beginning with, well, let's see. You could start with the prologue, or you could just start with the first chapter. Let's see.
Let's see here.
What do you think?
How long would you like me to blather on here,
four
Barbara?
4 minutes.
The prologue is 1, 2, 3 pages long. Now, is that too long
that's
to go?
That's good. Or I think it's good.
You think that's about right?
Yeah.
Good, because it stands well on its own, I think.
Let's do it.
Okay.
If you just tuned in again, you're listening to T. Jefferson Parker about to read The Fallen.
Okay. Okay, Barbara, this is going to be the prologue, the first 3 pages of the book. When the 6th floor of the Las Palmas Hotel caught fire, Robbie Brownlaw was in the diner across the street about to have lunch. It was a cool March afternoon in San Diego, and Brownlaw's turkey burger had just arrived when he saw orange flames roiling behind the hotel windows. He took a bite of the sandwich and hustled outside. The 6th-story windows blew, and an orange explosion knocked him back against the brick wall of the diner. Robbie heard screams up there in the fire. He had never heard screams like these. Then he heard all the yelling as people spilled from the restaurants and offices, pointing up at the Las Palmas while debris clattered to the asphalt, a splintered chair, a flaming lampshade, a nightstand with the drawers hanging out. Fire alarms shrieked competing warnings down the street. Brownlaw heard the guy screaming up on the 6th floor right through the ringing. Such fear! He looked up, still braced against the wall of the Sorrento diner, heart pounding like a dryer with a load of sneakers. Then he pushed off and ran toward the hotel, weaving between the stopped and honking cars, past the smoking carcass of a television set with a wall mount still on it that had crashed onto 4th. Brownlaw pulled up at the lobby of the hotel and let the onrush of humanity sweep past him. A young man in a blazer with a nameplate on and a phone to his ear, a wide-eyed oldster on a wobbling cane, a cleaning lady still wearing yellow rubber gloves and glaring at Robbie as if he had caused this. Then two more old men in shabby suits, a gangsta in a wife-beater shirt, swearing in Spanish, an Indian couple with three bawling children, a tall black man in a Sonics t-shirt, then a pretty young woman with a tangle of blonde hair, a black eye, and a bathrobe around her. Robbie headed up the steps past an old woman with a Yorkie in her arms. Robbie felt lucky and useful. The smoke was thick by the fourth landing and hot by the sixth. There was a weak moaning behind the first door he came to. It was locked, but it took him just one kick and a shoulder slam to break it down. Inside, he found a very old woman trapped under the mattress, which had apparently fallen onto her from the upended springs and frame. Only her neck and head and one arm were sticking out from under it. She looked up at him through the smoke as if he were God himself, and Brownlaw told her she'd be fine as he bent and dug his fingers into the mattress and pulled it away. The old woman couldn't get up, so Brownlaw just hauled her over his shoulders and ran back down the stairs with her. By the time he got back up to the sixth story, he was coughing hard and his eyes burned, and the sirens were wailing closer, and all but one of the room doors had been thrown open. Behind that door, Brownlaw could hear the screams of a man, the same terrified animal sounds he'd heard on the street. One kick later, the door shuddered open, and he was in. The smoke was thick, and Robbie could see the guy kneeling at the glassless window with his back to him. He was wearing shorts, and that was all. He was clutching the windowsill, bellowing at the city with wild fear. When Robbie was halfway across the room, the man turned and looked at him, and Robbie realized it wasn't fear at all. The man wheeled and came at him fast. He was very big, and he had Robbie in a wrestler's bear hug in an instant. He lifted Robbie off the floor and swung him around the room. During those two rapid orbits, Brownlaw stared from inches away into a face he would never forget or understand, a face of rage and desperation whose depths he could not measure. He tried to groin the guy with his knee, but the man was so tall that all he got was thigh. His gun was in his shoulder rig, which was under his sport coat, but his arms were pinned. He could not draw breath. At the end of that second rotation, he was pretty sure it was only two, Brownlaw felt the big hands lock around his arms and fling him out the window. The air was cool, and he felt absolutely alone. His first thought was that he could stop his fall using sheer willpower, and it seemed to be true. He focused all of his will on staying up, 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 up. Raising his arms, Robbie clawed the sky and felt his body suspended in the great liberty of air. He wasn't falling at all, but moving forward with good speed, and for an instant, he wondered if he might collide with the building across the street, or maybe even crash through a window, land on his feet, and get back to the Sorrento before the waitress took away his lunch. Then Brownlaw came to the end of his outward momentum. There was no hesitation, no moment of suspension, just a heavy pivot of weight, and down he went. Fast, then faster. He had never felt such speed before, nothing close to this. Faster still. Robbie Brownlaw, on his back now with his arms spread and his hands reaching for nothing, watched the top of the Las Palmas rise into the gray clouds and felt his ears bend forward in the awesome velocity of descent. He understood that he was now in the hands of something much larger than himself, if he was in any kind of hands at all. He thought of his young wife, Gina, with whom he was ferociously in love. He understood that the power of their love would be a factor in the outcome here. It seemed impossible that their days together were about to come to an end. Something like relief flowed through Robbie, and as the clouds rose away from him, he tried to figure out his estimated time of arrival. 16 feet per second? But is that only at first? Surely you accelerate faster. How high is a story in an old hotel? The phrase, 2 more seconds, came to his mind. But in spite of Robbie's belief that he would live to love Gina for years to come, a more convincing idea now flashed into his brain. This is it. He suddenly believed in the God he had doubted for all his life, his conversion completed in a fraction of a second. Then he let go. He felt insight and understanding. He saw that his first 5 years of life had been happy, that his childhood had been filled with wonder. His teenage years were a search for freedom. His young adulthood had been a storm of confusion and yearning for love. His 20s, a happy grind of Gina and friends, and Gina and friends, and Gina, and Gina, and Gina. And Robbie plummeted through the screams of sirens and alarms and onlookers and crashed through the faded red awning over the entrance to the Las Palmas Hotel like an anvil through a bedsheet and hit the sidewalk with a cracking, echoless thud.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, that's the first, that's the prologue. That is the injury or the fall that gives Robbie his curse and his gift of synesthesia.
Synesthesia. Now, at what point did the prologue to The Fallen come? Was that the first thing you wrote, or did that come later?
I wrote it first, Barbara. Yeah. I knew that I wanted to write a first-person novel where the narrator tells you the story himself, because I had just before this written a fairly long novel that was all pretty much third-person. And So I wrote that prologue first, knowing that that would be the only part of the book that would be outside of Robbie's voice.
Hmm. Interesting. Now, okay, so the idea comes, you know you want to use synesthesia, it's going to be a suspense novel. Then what? Are you a plotter? Are you an outliner? Do you know the ending? What happens next?
You know, I'm kind of a plotter. I'm kind of an outliner, but it's not always something that I'll write down. I've started novels based on little more than a notion of what I might be interested in and sort of a notion of a main character. I've also written 90-page single-spaced outlines for other novels. So I've kind of done it both ways. And I think for me the better way is to know as much about the book as I can know ahead of time in order to give me something to build on and to build toward. Now, that said, I will often know the ending. I certainly have a good understanding of my protagonist and the main characters before I start. I'll generally know the ending, and I may know some of the scenes. They'll kind of stack up like waves in a set. You can look out and you can see that one is going to kind of logically lead to another, and there's several out there. And then I'll begin. You know, I don't need to know too much. I always make a deal with myself before I start a book that I'm going to try to understand those basic things that I just outlined before I start. But I also am going to try to be, try to reserve the right to improve the book and change the outline as I see fit as the book progresses. And you always find that things come up that you can't plan that are serendipitous and kind of wonderful, and you need to put them in.
Mm-hmm. Well, how much about the character do you know then, your main characters? Do you do any sort of character studies or biographies? Or do they develop as you develop the story?
Yeah, the latter. You know, I know basics about, like, Robbie, for instance, the protagonist of this book. You know, I know what his tone of voice is going to be. I know kind of the core of his personality. I know his secrets. I know his position in life. I know how he sees people and how he sees himself. But you know, as to how you actually dramatize that or reveal those things, that comes in the writing of the scene, and that is where you're improvisational. You're making up Robbie's dialogue, what he might say. You know, you're making up Robbie's posture as he sits in a chair, you know, talking to his boss, for instance. And in those little things, in the making up, in that minute by minute creativity that you have at the word processor there, at the computer, that's where you really build your character. You know a lot more about that character when you're done with a book than you did before you started it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We have a few minutes left with T. Jefferson Parker, author of The Fallen, published by William Morrow. 13 novels later now.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever have slow periods or periods where you really just need to get yourself going? Or does that sort of thing just not happen with you at this point? And if it does happen, how do you get yourself going?
You know, it's... It's always hard to get started on a new book. You know, I found that the older I get and the more I write, the more difficult it is to begin a book. And oddly enough, the easier it often is to write one.
Hmm.
Yeah. It just the ideas and the I don't know. I'm picky. I'm picky about what story I tell because it's going to take me a whole year to write it, more or less. And you, as you know, you need to love your project in order to spend a whole year with it. You know, that's a long time. So you got to love your characters and your story and all. And sometimes it takes me a while to figure that kind of stuff out. You know, I derive a huge amount of inspiration from reading really, really good writers. I get a lot of inspiration for my work from other books, from movies, short stories, novels, nonfiction. And I have, you know, a great amount of clips pulled out of newspapers and magazines and things, topics, if you will, that interest me, like synesthesia did, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes time to write a book, I try to just pull out the things that are just really kind of trying to get written about inside me, you know, the topics that keep coming up, you know, the notes on things that won't go away, you know. I mean, here's a for instance, and I may never write about rabies, but I think rabies is really, really interesting, and
mm-hmm.
I would like to have a character who has rabies. I would like to write that character someday,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know if I ever will, but that's an example of something from my clip file that's getting really, really thick. I've got a lot of neat stuff about that now, and one of these days I'm going to get it into a book, and it's really going to work, you know?
That's interesting.
I hope. I mean, stuff like that, you know,
sure.
Synesthesia, rabies. I mean, you know, I'm interested in all sorts of, you know, criminal things because I write, thrillers, you know, crime novels. So I'm always interested in the FBI Law Enforcement Bulletin and the Sheriff's Department Journal and all that kind of jazz. You never know when you're going to kick up something really interesting.
One thing I can say about your work, I think one reason I love it so much is that you write wonderful suspense. You also have just such wonderful characters that are developed and have all kinds of layers, and I appreciate that. You're not going for sort of, you know, simply getting somebody to sit down and be glued to the page, but you're doing something more, and I appreciate that.
Well, thank you. Those are really good words, and I'm trying to do that. So those words mean a lot to me. I thank you.
One more thing before we go, and perhaps you can come back when this goes into paper, but paperback. But the name Brownlaw, I'm always asking you about names of your characters. How'd this one come to you?
Brownlaw?
Yeah.
I don't know. I really have no idea where
he's such
from.
A black, you know, and white kind of guy.
Yeah, I don't know. You hear it somehow, and it gets caught in your brain matter somehow, and it's there to pull out. You know, Asplund is another funny name. I've been asked, you know, how I came up with the name Garrett Asplund,
right.
And because it's just such an oddball name. I couldn't tell you. All I know is that I heard it spoken or written somewhere before, and it's in the book.
Yeah, interesting. Where are you tonight? Are you in L.A. doing something?
Yeah, I'm in L.A. right now, hanging out with my buddy Ken, and we're in Lita's office here at Borders Books, beautiful Borders Books in, where are we? Westwood. And we're about to go to a bookstore in Pasadena.
Okay, an appearance for you?
Yeah, appearance at Vroman's Books in Pasadena.
Tonight, great.
Yep.
Any last words for the writers?
Well,
struggling through it.
You know, for the new writers or the young writers getting started, you just got to remember to read really good stuff. Read the stuff that makes your scalp crawl and your eyes water, and that's the stuff that'll sustain you, and that's the stuff that'll teach you.
Hmm. Well, great. Good luck with this book.
Thanks a ton.
I'm sure it's going to do well, like all the others. It's so great. So thanks, and come back with the paperback.
Nice talking to you, Barbara.
Bye bye. That was T. Jefferson Parker, author of The Fallen, published by William Morrow. It's such a cool book, as I've been going on and on about it. So he's at Vroman's in Pasadena tonight. When we return, Mark Bittner, author of The Wild Parrots of Telegraph Hill, will be with us. So stay with us. Don't go anywhere.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. We gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett on Thursdays at 5 p.m. on KUCI-FM in Irvine. Bye-bye.
Yee-haw! The opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the management of KUCI or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about this show, go to KUCI.org.
And hello again. You are listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI-FM, broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We've been here since 5 o'clock. We had on T. Jefferson Parker, the first half of the show, author of the new novel, The Fallen. And we're about to bring on Mark Bittner, who is author of The Wild Parrots of Telegraph Hill, published by Three Rivers Press. First, let me say that you can go to penonfire.com if you'd like to listen to some archived shows. We've started to podcast, and there's maybe a couple of dozen shows up there. This one should go up next week. We're trying to be current as well as putting on older shows that were good ones. I've been on the air for almost 9 years, so there's a ton of shows, and we aim to get a lot of them up there. So do visit penonfire.com, click on the radio tower. It'll take you to the radio page, and you can hook into the podcast if you like. In any case, my next guest is Mark Bittner, author of The Wild Parrots of Telegraph Hill. He is also the subject of a documentary film with the same title that you can find at your local video DVD store. And he still lives in San Francisco on Telegraph Hill. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Great to have you on.
Thank you.
I've been aware of you and your book for such a long time, and I think what sort of brought it to the forefront was an article in the Los Angeles Times. Oh, it's probably been a couple of months at this point, talking about you and your neighbors there on Telegraph Hill and controversy about a tree that was to be cut down, a tree that the parrots very much like and make their home in. So here you are. I'm so curious about the tree. What's been going on?
Well, I don't really know, because it got to be quite contentious, and to sort of calm things down, we were taken out of it. It's the mayor's office that's now negotiating with the owner of the trees. They don't actually live in the trees, but they do use them a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole thing sort of started because he'd wanted to cut them down. We said, wait a minute, let's talk about this. We were talking about it, and suddenly one day, without even telling us it was going to happen, he started cutting them down. And that's when I ran underneath them to stop the crew from cutting, and that's when it all blew up.
Oh, dear. So at what point, then, did the book begin, The Wild Parrots of Telegraph Hill? How did the book come about?
I started writing in, I think, about 96. I was fed up with doing odd jobs. I really wanted to do something. I wanted to make some money somehow doing something that I liked doing. So I wrote an article for a magazine, and they accepted it. So that inspired me to try to write a whole book, and started from then.
And then what did happen? Did you do sort of a formal book proposal for the book, or did an agent and you kind of get together after the article come out?
Well, you know, I was reading books on how to get published, and it all seemed quite daunting. But I didn't have to go through any of that. I was very lucky. I was doing a feeding one day, just feeding the parrots, and she came by. She was just somebody passing by, and we got into a conversation. And, you know, rather than have to go through all that thing of, you know, what's your market, you know, what other books will you be competing, all this kind of stuff that you read about,
right.
She just, you know, had me write up an outline in two chapters, and she took it around and found a publisher.
Interesting. So then an advance was forthcoming, hopefully.
Yes.
And allowed you to write the book.
Yeah.
What did you do then? Did you outline the book? How did you start?
Well, I had the outline that I was told that I didn't really have to stick to it, but I liked the outline, and I actually wrote an outline that corresponded to what I wanted to do. And they generally have you write two chapters just as samples of your writing. Can you fulfill this? And they liked it, so I just started writing from the beginning then, and that altered those two chapters a little bit, because as you come through it from the front, you know, you start seeing things a little differently. Part of the problem I was having for a long time was that I was still with the parrots, and I didn't know where it was ending.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I had to feel what the end was to really write it. And so for a long time, I'd been working around writing a book, writing little pieces and sections. But once I left the hill, as you see in the movie, I leave the hill. Then I was free to really start writing, and I did.
And then you returned.
Yes.
That's very cool.
Yeah. I actually came back here to caretake a place right next door to where I had been living,
mm-hmm.
and I was just writing this book, and, you know, I pretty much knew how the end went, but then I started feeding the birds again, which almost complicated things. But, you know, you can't do stuff. You know, if you're going to write a sincere book, you have to do what's sincerely happening, not you don't do things to make the book work or something.
Right. Unless, of course, it's fiction.
Right.
But when it's nonfiction, we try to stick to what happened.
Yes, exactly. That's the general rule.
As we've all been finding out. The movie was wonderful. I rented the film a few weeks ago and what a moving story.
Yeah, I'm very happy with the way it turned out. I think I get a lot of questions, you know, from people who haven't seen one or the other, and they're sort of assuming in those questions that one is based on the other, and they're quite independent projects.
Mm-hmm.
They're complementary, you know, rather than one being derived from the other.
Right, right. I didn't get the sense really that the movie was taken from the book, or the book sort of came after. Will you read to us?
Sure.
And if you just tuned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing. I am here with Mark Bittner, author of The Wild Parrots of Telegraph Hill, A Love Story with Wings, published by Three Rivers Press, and he's about to read.
Okay, I'm going to read this one passage, and I'm going to cut out a middle section and sort of describe it.
Okay.
Okay. And this sort of explains where I come from. In the spring of 1974, my home was a broken-down VW van parked in San Francisco's North Beach neighborhood. I was 22 years old and leading the life of a Dharma bum, a term coined by the poet Gary Snyder that means a homeless seeker of truth. I'd met Alan, the van's owner, the previous spring when I was living in Berkeley. Alan was a hippie jeweler and street vendor, and I was a street musician. He liked my music, and we became acquainted. But my musical career had come to an abrupt end, which is why I was living in his van. When I was a young boy, I'd had the usual ambitions, private eye, baseball player, or astronaut. But when I turned 14, I began to recognize that I was different somehow and that I was never going to have a normal life. So I switched to what I thought a more appropriate occupation. I decided to become a great novelist. I liked writing, but I kept making the same unsettling discovery. Every writer whose work I admired had ended up alcoholic, poverty-stricken, crazy, or suicidal. Since not even one of them had been a healthy and sane human being, I made what I thought was a better career choice, rock and roll musician. So at that time, you know, the big die-off, rock and roll musicians hadn't started, and it really did seem like a healthy thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But rock and roll, I mean, musician, I wasn't suited to be a musician. It was just like, I think back in the 40s, everybody wanted to be a movie star.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was growing up, everyone wanted to be a musician. And, you know, by trying to be something that I wasn't meant to be, it started creating a lot of problems for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually it all fell apart. So I'm going to resume at that point.
Okay.
I devoted myself so exclusively to this one goal that when it collapsed, I had nothing to fall back on. I couldn't see anything else I wanted to do. It was an extremely dark period for me. I got so far down that I could barely function. One night, I started having vaguely suicidal feelings, and after debating it at length, I decided to call the Suicide Prevention Center. The man who answered the phone sounded harassed. "Geez, man, you picked a really bad time to call. Could you just hold on until morning and call back then?" I paused, said, "Sure," and he hung up. Then, as though fortune were looking out for me, my sister Beth came to town. She'd decided to move to San Francisco and had stopped in Berkeley to look for me. I told her what had happened, and she offered to put me up until I could pull myself back together. And so I sort of spent the next 15 years on the street.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Thank you so much. You are listening to Writers on Writing. That was Mark Bittner reading from The Wild Parrots of Telegraph Hill. How do you keep going when you're dealing with other challenges, whether they be money or housing or politics or whatever? I mean, writers seem to, so many writers seem to have other things to deal with while they're writing.
Yeah.
And it can kind of put a damper on the creativity and put sort of close you down if you don't somehow find a way to keep going and get the writing done.
Yeah, well, you have to be disciplined and you have to, I don't know, if you really believe in your project, I think that really helps because it's easy to get distracted on a long project. I really had to write this book. I knew I had to write the book, so... You know, there was a lot of stuff that was distracting happening at the same time, but you just put in the time every day. I'm actually having problems right now, in a sense, because it's sort of a problem of success that I'm trying to get started on a new book, but I keep having obligations from the first book, and that's really my big problem right now, so to speak.
Do you mean like appearances,
yeah,
and touring and that kind of thing?
Yeah. I finally had to call a halt to it because I'm not getting any work done on the new book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, you think that, at least I used to think before my book came out, that once your book comes out and you're in a hotel room, you know, you do your little appearance and then you sit in the hotel room and you write. But it doesn't happen like that.
No, you need to get settled, in my mind at least. I can't do it unless I'm settled, so.
Mm-hmm. So when you are going through... Say you're going a little slower than you like. Do you have any ways of tricking yourself to get going, or do you have techniques? Or
you mean while writing?
Yeah,
I don't. I never had that problem with this book. I had so many notes. I had so much material to exclude to work out. I mean, to work on that. I don't know why, but I never had that problem. I never felt like writer's block or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
This next project is going to be quite different. It's about my time on the street, and I don't know if that will affect it. But on the Parrot book, it was just every day I'd get a lot of work done.
I wonder, too, whether it's different writing nonfiction than fiction, because at least with nonfiction, you know kind of what's supposed to happen or what happened, you know, and it kind of it does keep you going.
What do you write?
Well, my book, Pen on Fire, is nonfiction. Very much it's nonfiction about writing, but I'm working on a novel now, and I find that Pen on Fire sort of flowed out, and I had more than enough for a finished book.
Mm-hmm.
But with the novel, there's so much I sort of need to know or ways I need to be rooted in the story that at times it's difficult because I'm not sure what's supposed to happen next. I know where I'm going, but I don't know what's supposed to happen at this minute. And it's a whole different experience from working on nonfiction.
When I was young, I wanted to be a novelist. I never wrote a novel, but I used to write short stories, and then I've written a lot of songs. So I'd never really written nonfiction, and I really had to develop a whole new language. That was something that I had to struggle with for a while. Now I see myself. I stopped reading fiction a while ago. Now I read almost exclusively nonfiction. So I'm sort of in that territory. I like creative nonfiction. That's really my interest.
What are you reading? What are you reading right now?
Right now I'm reading Ramblin' Man, The Life and Times of Woody Guthrie by Ed Cray. And I'm also reading Jaber Crow. Do you know that?
No, I don't.
That's Wendell Berry. It's a novel.
Yeah, so do you find then that it helps, you know, reading sort of in a similar genre? I mean, you're writing nonfiction, reading nonfiction.
Not really. It's kind of funny. When I was thinking about writing, when I wanted to be a writer, I sort of left off with Henry Miller. He was the last author that I was reading. And I liked his idea that, you know, no more novels will write art, but it'll come out of our lives. You know, we can... I don't know how honest he was, but I liked that vision that he had. But then I stopped writing, you know, prose after that. I started working on song. But I find myself sort of coming back to where I was when I left off, and that was his notions. So I like writing, trying to write deep from what actually happened to you.
Yes. Now, are you at all concerned with... you know, in terms of writing, it sounds like a memoir. Worried at all about the frayed debacle that just, does that concern you at all? Are you...
Well, no,
you know,
because, you know, I just do what I think is good and what I think is right. I mean, I suppose it affects markets and things like that somewhat, but I believe in what I'm doing, so I don't worry about somebody else's thing too much, I guess.
What about markets? Because I think often writers allow the market to enter their office or their writing space and worry about whether what they're writing will be accepted, will reflect them in a good way, a bad way, will hurt somebody. Do you think about all that, or do you just pretty much keep it out of your writing space when you're working?
I don't know. You know, Parrots, I sort of felt like I was... stranger at a party. I really didn't know how to think. I hadn't spent a whole life thinking about getting a book out. So when I was sort of doing it all right on the spot, and I felt like a stranger at a party. I'm just introducing myself, you know, and you don't reveal your whole self in that situation. You feel your way through trying to figure out what you can say. And, you know, you don't know what editors do and any of this stuff. So it's hard for me to say for the next book, what I want to do is I want to write a draft that nobody else will ever read, but to get the voice, you know, and then you go back and change what needs to be changed, and I'll have a better idea of, I can't really answer your question right now. I don't really know.
You are listening to Writers on Writing. We have a few minutes left with Mark Bittner, author of The Wild Parrots of Telegraph Hill. Now, did the book sell rather quickly once your agent had what she needed to approach publishers?
Yeah. She first go around, she got it. She got a publisher right away.
And then the editor that you worked with, did he or she pretty much get the book? And were you happy in working that with him or her that you were able to do sort of fulfill your vision and not have it be tampered with?
Yeah, they let me say whatever I wanted to say. I was sort of hoping, and I know it's changed. I mean, I was sort of hoping that we'd go deeply into it together, but that's not the way editors work now. They're more like project managers.
Mm-hmm.
And what really happened there was the copy editor liked the book, and he really went into detail on it. And that's the person who actually did most of the real line editing and all of that. They didn't make very many changes in the book. They didn't ask for... They suggested that I cut out one chapter, and I really agreed with them. The chapter was always a big question to me anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And that was about it. Otherwise, they pretty much left the book alone, but the copy editor got into the book. He wanted to make it a better book, so...
Mm-hmm.
I kind of think that right now in publishing, it's, you know, it's not like it used to be. It's not like the old, you know, the heavy editors who were really into literature. There's not very much of that right now.
Mm. Yeah, there's a lot of concern with the bottom line that seems make staffs kind of skimpy or overworked, therefore seeming skimpy and not a lot of time. The cover is lovely. I love the cover of your book. Did you have any input on it?
No.
Were you happy with it?
No, that's kind of a funny story, actually. There were originally more blue crowns on the cover than there are now, and there were only two blue crowns in the flock, and I complained about it. And they said, well, we like the cover, and we're not going to change it. And then the salesman started reading the book, and they said, wait a minute, you got too many blue crowns. Then they changed it.
I was going to say, I was going to ask you if, which obviously it's not the birds, but I was going to ask if these are the birds because they look similar to the ones in the film.
They're all photos. They're individual photos that I took, and then they're photoshopped and put together online.
How wonderful. How wonderful.
Yeah.
Tell us your website.
Well, I have several, and I'm going to be combining them all into one in April, and I'd rather give that address then.
Okay.
It's markbittner.net.
Okay. How do you hope your book affects readers, and how has it affected readers? Who do you hear from people?
I hear from people a lot, yeah. It has, I guess you would say, sort of a cult following, people that read it and really love it, and, you know... One of the things that I wanted, I really wanted to get two things across. One, nature is a serious subject. I mean, it's not, some people think of it as, you know, well, they'll say about my book, well, it's not just a book about birds. Like, you know, don't worry, it's not just about birds. And I'll do that myself sometimes, but one of my points was that I discovered that they are real characters. They're real living beings. And it's a perfectly legitimate, strong subject. So that's one thing I wanted to get across. And the other thing is, I mean, we live in one of the most materialistic times in the history of civilization, I think. And we need to change that. And it's really, you know, the chasing after money that's got to change. I think that's really the biggest problem we have today.
Hmm. How has that affected the birds?
Excuse me?
How has that... I had the sense from the movie a bit that that has affected the birds or the press that I've read in terms of the tree being cut and all of that.
They're very popular. They're little celebrities here. And that's... I mean, one of the reasons I wrote the book was because there was a guy studying a flock in Chicago, a flock of parrots. And Fish and Game, because they're non-native there in Illinois, wanted to destroy the flock. And the only reason they survived was because the neighborhood came together and protected them.
Mm.
So he said, you have to make your birds famous because they could fall into jeopardy otherwise.
Interesting.
And they are, you know, they're beloved, so they have that now.
And, you know, I can see where that would give you sort of the passion for the project.
Yeah, well, they're friends of mine. That's how, I mean, they really are. I was lonely, and they were my friends, and they were good friends.
Yeah. Well, again, I would hope that people interested would read this book, The Wild Parrots of Telegraph Hill, and see the film, because they're a wonderful complement for each other.
Yeah.
Any final words for the writers listening who may be struggling through a project?
Oh, I think it's important to have a real story to tell. I mean, I think a problem with a lot of books is there's a writer going around looking for something to write about. But, you know, you have to find that story inside of you or in your life somehow. I think those are the best stories.
Yes. Yeah, the story you have to tell.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Mark, thank you so much for
taking
the time, and I'll look forward to your next book.
I really enjoyed this.
Thank you.
Okay.
That was Mark Bittner, author of The Wild Parrots of Telegraph Hill, published by Three Rivers Press, speaking to us from Telegraph Hill in San Francisco. Again, there's a film that I found at my local video store called The Wild Parrots of Telegraph Hill. It was a delight, a moving story, and check it out. What else can I tell you? If you want to know more about Writers on Writing, go to my website. It's penonfire.com. There is a radio page. You can click on the radio tower on my website, and it will take you to the radio page that will show you who's coming on the show. From that point, you can also listen to podcasts and archive shows. You don't need a Mac to do that, or an iPod. So any computer, you can listen. I'm going to leave you with a quote, as I do every week. This week, it's by Sinclair Lewis. He said, "Every compulsion is put upon writers to become safe, polite, obedient, and sterile." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next time. Thank you.